The scripture reading for today comes from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 14, verses 1, 7 through 14. One Sabbath, when he went to dine at the house of a ruler who belonged to the Pharisees, they were watching him. Now he told a parable to those who were invited, when he marked how they chose the places of honor, saying to them, "When you are invited by anyone to a marriage feast, do not sit down in the place of honor, lest a more eminent man than you be invited by him. And he who invited you both will come and say to you, 'Give place to this man.' And then you will begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go and sit in the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he may say to you, 'Friend, go up higher.' And then you will be honored in the presence of all who sit at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." He said also to the man who had invited him, "When you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your kinsmen or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return, and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed, because they cannot repay you. You will be repaid at the resurrection of the just." The word of the Lord.
When the rabbis read, they walk into the text. They bring themselves to it and step across the edge of the scroll, jump up onto its body, bouncing a little, believing it will hold their weight. And then on hands and knees, they crawl through the furrows of words, examining, brushing away dirt, not like an archaeologist hoping to unearth some dead, hardened thing, but like a botanist examining growth patterns and evidence of the soil's mineral content, water content, or where there is deep clay. And then they look for the cracks in the soil from which the word emerged. It's the cracks, the gaps, that will allow them a way in to the text. The Midrash explores these gaps. Stories and parables, proverbs and legal case studies prove their skill at mining those gaps. The text is changed by having been there. There are footprints left behind, indentations, great hollowed out places, and covered over smoothed out portions. Once an oral wisdom that required a speaker, and what is an individual speaker if not a unique interpreter, Midrash kept the text from hardening into stone. It was kept alive and fertile, even malleable, but with deep and unknown roots. That, however, is not how I was taught to read our holy book. I was taught to search for answers, one right answer, to calculate the calculable, the defendable, the uncontradictable truth. But to the rabbis, it is not a book of monolithic answers. It's a porous book of brilliant questions. The ancient rabbis read the sacred text as questions and then answer the questions with other questions and provide answers with stories of possibilities. The tents of opposing camps are set up on the text side by side, conclusions leaned up against refutations, some decaying, some flourishing. All interpretations are partly wrong and partly right, which is why many need to be included so that something like the truth can be glimpsed or gotten close to. When the Talmud talks about the rabbi's students, it doesn't say that there were 24,000. It says that there were 12,000 pairs of students, because the text is best studied with someone else, with a partner, someone to fight with, someone to debate and challenge and disagree, someone to argue with and wrestle with the questions so they can be refined. The Talmud interprets the phrase "enemies at the gate" from Psalm 127 as referring to people studying Torah together, standing together at one desk, the gate. Even a father and a son, or a teacher and his students who are studying Torah together in one gate, become enemies of one another. But they do not move from there until they become devoted friends, one Midrash says. The study of the Christian scriptures needs this kind of midrashic inquiry that the rabbis have practiced for hundreds of years. Without a kind of deep, playful, lively digging into the text, it is left to atrophy, and we are left with something barely alive. Now here, in these three pericopes — a pericope is a small portion of scripture, sometimes a complete story or a saying, sometimes just a scrap — but here are these three pericopes connected loosely by the theme of eating. There's a healing, a parable, and an apocalypse. But there maybe is some progression here. I don't know. Maybe there's some interdependence here that's not apparent at first. Maybe even some kind of awkward admission in these different pericopes linked together. And oddly, what the reading for today, if you notice, jumps from chapter 14, verse 1 to chapter 14, verse 8, verse 7. Verses 2 through 6 aren't included. Now, maybe you know this, I don't know, but these readings we do every week, they're put together by a kind of a commission, the Revised Common Lectionary, it's called, and it's put together by this consultation on the common text. It's kind of a nefarious organization that puts together this three-year cycle of what should be read every week in the United States and they try to put it all together. They bring everybody together here. The U.S. Conference of Bishops is in on it, the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops, American and Canadian Episcopal Church, Protestant Church, Lutherans, Anglicans of all sorts, Presbyterians, Methodists, all these people, even some Australians. So obviously they have to accommodate a lot of different kinds of feelings, but they put these things together and prescribe them for us to read, which is fine, but I must say that they are often accused of having some kind of agenda, some kind of theological or cultural or political agenda, because they choose what we read and what texts we don't. They have, for instance, it's a three-year cycle, and each year has a gospel associated with it. We're in the third year, year C, which is Luke. But you might be catching on now that there's four gospels, 3 years. For some reason, John doesn't make the cut. I don't know if they couldn't agree. Or maybe there's just something in John that's just too much. But really, when I look at these things, I like, for instance, why did they decide to jump from 14 verse 1 to verse 7 here? Why did they decide to leave that out? You know, when I read these things and see what they choose and how they choose, sometimes I don't think that their agenda is so much nefarious as it is a desire for blandness. It's just getting all those people — Lutherans, Methodists, Anglicans, Canadians — all these people and making them all happy, it seems that the only way to do that is to take away that which is controversial, that which is not easily understandable, or maybe something that is not understandable at all. No, I think sometimes the agenda is just to make the whole thing more palatable, like pablum, like inoffensive oatmeal. We're talking no raisins, no cinnamon, no apple slices, no brown sugar. Yeah, or maybe they're just not putting a lot into it. I don't know. They get tired. You know, it's hard. I mean, these are not enemies at the gate here, and they're not trying to work everything out. They just have, they have some criteria, and they're on a, it's a commission, and they're just like, nobody's wrestling anything here, and maybe there's somebody on the night shift who has to do this week's, and, you know, the lectionaries that make the night shift, they're not the top of the lectionary class. No. So maybe that's why sometimes you get at something like this, where it seems to me the part they left out is kind of the most important part of the whole text here. I don't know if you know, so we start out here. It says that from Luke 14:1 says, on one occasion, Jesus was going to the house of a leader of the Pharisees to eat a meal on the Sabbath, and they were watching him closely. That's how it starts. But they leave out, just then, in front of him, there was a man who had dropsy. And Jesus asked the lawyers and Pharisees, is it lawful to cure people on the Sabbath or not? But they were silent. So Jesus took him and healed him and sent him away. And then he said to them, if one of you has a child or an ox that has fallen into a well, will you not immediately pull it out on the Sabbath day? And they could not reply to this. That's the part that's left out. After that, it's just all about how to behave when you're eating a meal, which seems less compelling to me. I don't know. Otherwise, how are these all related? Well, there is one thing that kind of maybe seems a little bit interesting here, is that Jesus is pretty rude at this meal. Well, maybe combative is a better way to put it. I don't know. He's just, his manners are not good. In the part that we do get to read, thanks Canada, we're able to see that, so, okay, let's back it up here. So they're just walking along here with Jesus, and maybe they're walking in silence. I don't know. They're walking, and Jesus sees this guy. This is the part we don't get to read. And he sees this guy and with dropsy, and dropsy is kind of like an edema, like it's water. It's very painful from what I hear. And he turns to the people he's walking with. They're going to have a dinner at the Pharisee's house, and they see this guy needs healing. He's in pain. The guy doesn't approach him. The guy doesn't ask Jesus to heal him. The guy maybe, I don't know, he doesn't even have a name. Doesn't seem like Jesus even talks to him. Jesus points him out to his companions and says, hey, is it okay for me to heal him on the Sabbath? His companions, they know Jesus, what Jesus thinks about it. So they don't say anything. Because they're going to, I don't know, they're going to get in trouble, or they just feel stupid, or I don't know. Why? We don't know. It's not explained. And so Jesus kind of just rolls his eyes and heals the guy and says, you would pull your ox or your kid out of a well on the Sabbath? You're not even going to say anything? No, they don't say anything. What are they thinking? What are they thinking? Are they thinking, why did he heal that guy? Are they thinking that, no, he should not have healed them on the Sabbath? Are they thinking, this guy's getting increasingly irritating? We don't know. They arrive at the meal. These other guests are there. They're all taking their places. But this is the part we read. This is the part that's included, right? The seating arrangements. The other guests, they're taking their places, but Jesus stands apart watching them. Then he's shaking his head. And he says, see, That's the problem with you guys. Look, you always choose the best spots. He's paraphrasing Proverbs here. He says, don't you know that you are going to humiliate yourselves? I'll tell you what you do. You go to a meal like this, you take the worst spot. Then the host comes in and moves you up, and bingo, there's honor. Everybody's like, oh yeah, look at you, are important. The host moved you up. That's what you should be doing. And they just look at him. They don't say anything about that either. Maybe they're wondering, like, what's going on? Is this still about the dropsy thing? I don't know. They just sit there. So after he's done insulting the guests, he turns to the host. And he says, you know what your problem is? You invite people just so you can be honored, so you can be paid back. What are you thinking, inviting your friends and your relatives to eat with you? You should invite the poor, the crippled, and people that can never pay you back. Do that, and then you'll get paid back when you die. The host says nothing, looking nervously at the guests like, where did you guys stop before here? You know, what is the point of all this? Well, the first part is about this hypocritical adherence to the law. Maybe the second part is some helpful advice on how not to humiliate yourself at a dinner party and how to, I don't know, instead honor yourself. And this third part is about how you should never bring honor to yourself. It's confusing, frankly, to me. Instead, you should bring shame on yourself by inviting unclean guests. What is Jesus going off on here? Why are everybody just sitting there watching this? They don't know what he's getting at. Maybe it's because Jesus is feeling nervous. Maybe people finally have gotten a little bit sick of him. This whole thing does open with they were watching him closely. Who? The Pharisees? The religious leaders? But they don't say anything. Are they being polite? I don't know. Nervous? And amidst all this Emily Post advice, Jesus heals this man at the beginning with dropsy. And it's just so random how he heals him. I mean, he just relates it in an offhand story while they're going by this guy. What is Luke including that for? It just, none of this makes any sense. What gives? Of all the things we have in this story, it seems like the most important question, the question that cannot be taken care of with this offhandedness, the most glaring question right there has to do with this healing that they left out. If Jesus can just heal people that randomly, with just that kind of a side casualness, why doesn't he do that to everyone? We can give, you know, take or leave the best place to sit at a dinner party. But what's a little harder to take, and especially when we know somebody in our lives, somebody we care about, somebody who needs healing, and we all need healing to some, in some ways, but some people, I don't. That's a good question. That's a deep question. The rabbis say that when you study Torah, you release more of God's mercy into the world. And so one might study the text to try and find an answer or solve a mystery or turn everything into a discernible seating chart. Or one can study the scriptural text and see these deep questions and live with these deep questions and know that that act is releasing more of God's mercy into the world.